working as a salesman, we could tell when people had already made the buy, and they were just sitting ducks. And the dealership had things structured, so those people would get reamed.
Something will just kind of call out to me, and it'll say, and I think, there's something in there, I don't know what, and almost always, if I just go in there and look around, something will, there'll be something that I was hoping, you know, looking for.
The prices are astronomical. What they charge you is like 10, 20, 100 times what the product is really worth anyway.
You just want it because it's right in front of you, and you're here at the moment.
The 90 days, same as cash, she was a sucker for that.
Oh, yeah.
Knowing that I could do it and then get two or three and then, okay, well, we need $600.
And I need a little child. I want it.
And she would get it. And then 90
and
days.
And we pay the price.
And they're like, well, we owe the money. Well, I only got $200. Well, you know, and then boom, and we were stuck. So that happened two or three times. We know better now, so that's why we're not going to do it.
One of the things he really touched on tonight was, you know, how they will shelf products, how they will, you know, how they will position them in the store to catch your eye.
Ladies and gentlemen, please welcome nationally syndicated radio host and best-selling author, Dave Ramsey.
This is a very, very important lesson. If you get this lesson and you understand the gist of it, it will almost guarantee your financial peace. You see, we live in the most marketed-to culture in the history of the world. We have more people trying to sell us more stuff, more ways than at any other time in history. And this is a lesson about the buyer being aware. Beware. Buyer, beware. The phrase in Latin, we used to use it in the real estate business, is let the buyer beware. Caveat emptor. Let the buyer beware. You have got to be aware. Because I'll tell you what, for sure, there are some of these out there. You always wondered what a wolf in sheep's clothing looked like. And now you know, courtesy of Financial Peace. If you'll turn in your workbooks to the buyer beware lesson, we will begin to fill in the blanks as we learn about being wary consumers. Now, it's not to say that we can't enjoy the process even of being sold something. I'm a salesman at heart. I sell ideas these days. But I love selling things, and I'll tell you what, I enjoy being sold by a good salesman. I enjoy the process. They make it fun to buy. A bad salesman rubs you the wrong way, and you're conflicted the whole time you're doing it, right? But a good salesman, boy, you just enjoy the whole process. And I can tell you this for sure. Companies out there use every possible angle to aggressively compete for your money. Their job, their goal, their very mission statement is to make a profit. How do you think they do that if they don't get your money? They have to get your money. If they don't get your money more often than you keep your money, they close the doors and go home. They go broke. And there's a lot of stuff and a lot of services in our culture today for sale, chasing just a few dollars. And so they have become very, very adept at going after our dollars, and the intensity of the marketing and the advertising is increasing at an alarming rate from a consumer advocate's perspective. American Demographics says that in 1971, the average consumer had 560 advertisements presented to them a day. By the new millennium, the year 2000, we have had over 4,000 advertisements a day presented to us. Billboards, television, radio, the internet. You can't even begin to get near the internet without getting socked with six or eight on the opening page. advertising impressions. Marketing, 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 marketing. And it does have an impact because we now have a culture that buys more than it's ever bought before. We have a gross national product in this country where somewhere between 60 and 70% in a given year of the entire economy is based on consumer spending. Consume, not produce. Consumption represents over half of who we are as a country right now, and it's marketing, 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 marketing. Marketing's fun. It's not evil. I'm in the business of selling books and tapes. It's okay. It's okay to sell some things, but as a consumer, we have to be aware. And if we don't learn to say, no thank you, I'm just looking, then we can run into some serious problems in our finances big time. There are four major ways these companies go after our money. The first one is personal selling. One-on-one where someone is there saying, can I help you please? Now, that could be obviously in a retail setting where a simple clerk comes up to assist you with a clothing purchase or an electronics purchase or something along those lines. It could be in the investment field. It could be in the car business. But I can tell you this, all across America every week there are huge meetings with 8 and 10 and 20,000 people paying $500, $300, $200 to spend a day with the professional trainers, teaching them how to talk, how to walk, how to dress, so that they can more likely influence your purchase decision. Because as a sales rep, as Zig Ziglar says, as a sales rep, if you don't begin to influence people's purchase decisions, you have skinny kids. So these salespeople become very, very good at it. I grew up in a salesman's household, so I went to those sales training things when I was a little kid. I've watched this as a phenomenon has grown and as the art of salesmanship has increased, and it's very real. Now, I don't have any illusions about this. I know that some of you couldn't be sold anything by certain people in certain settings, and that's fine. But these people have an influence overall on average, or they don't justify their existence economically within that company, and they go bye-bye. And most of those salespeople are on some kind of a commission, so they have a personal conflict of interest, a reason to sell you something. A car salesperson who doesn't know how to talk properly, how to use the verbal barrage properly, will go broke. If you walk up and you're looking at a little car and you say, do you have this in blue? The car salesman that says yes is soon out of the business. He or she is taught very early on in Salesmanship 101 to, instead of simply answering your question, to answer your question with yet another question, a series of alternative questions called an alternative close, to where he can begin to fill out the order, and then miraculously that car that you really need can appear right there available to you. For instance, do you have that in blue? His answer, if he's smart, would be, well, I think we might. I'll check. But let me ask, if we do, would you prefer to have it with the sport package or the luxury package? Oh, luxury package. Great. Now, are you concerned about airbags on the driver's side as well as on the passenger side? And did you want the one with the moonroof? Check, check. Did you want the one with four wheels? Check. Right? And they go right down the list and begin to develop a whole plan there. And miraculously, as you have filled out the order, answering a series of yes or no and choice questions, alternative closed questions, then they say, you know what? I think we have that car in the computer, which means it's not on their lot. They're going to buy it from the dealer across town, have it delivered in the next few minutes. And it'll be there for you to look at by morning after they detail it to make it available to you, because it has to smell good and the seats have to be slick. This is not a game, is it? And if we as consumers think it's a game, we are going to be B-R-O-K-E, broke, all of our lives. The second thing they use to sell us and to teach us how to buy their product and make it easy for us is, of course, financing. Now, we talk a lot about financing or debt in this course, financial piece, and I'll tell you what, it's a big part of marketing. Making it easy to buy is kind of like these guys. Will this be cash or a major blot on your credit record? Where are you with that? We do things like 90 days same as cash, right? And did you know that 78% of the 90 days same as cash contracts convert to payments, which are usually at around 24% APR, with a rule of 78s, which is a prepayment penalty where they tack it on again and get you again? You know, it's amazing to me that we get these things in the newspaper. These no interest for a year, no interest, no interest, no interest flyers. And you stop and think, you know, here's one from a furniture store as an example. And you're looking through this thing and you're thinking, wow, look at this. It says 12 months, no interest. You flip it over and it says 12 months, no interest. And you open it up inside and it says 12 months, no interest. Well, let me tell you what this cost in a major city in North America, a medium-sized city in the top 100 markets. If you were to print this and you were a furniture store, and you pay for the printing and the delivery, and you deliver this and set it on the dock at the newspaper, in order for that local newspaper to insert this in there and then deliver it to the consumer's home, in major cities in North America, it's $24,000 per Sunday is the average. Plus they paid for the printing and the delivery and the graphic work to set it up. Now let's see here. Let me think about this. They paid $25,000 to $30,000 to send this into your living room to give you the opportunity to have free money. Okay, well, it is 0% interest, but let me ask you a question. How naive are we? I mean, do you think that possibly the cost of the interest is built in to the cost of the furniture? Did this occur to anyone? I mean, this is just driving me nuts, you know? You're beating them up. You're abusing them. And they know, too, that 78% of you do not pay this off during the 12 months, during the 90 days. 8 out of 10 times, you're going to end up paying the interest. And so they have a finance company setting over to the side, either that they own or that they sell this paper to. And they can actually make a profit on that piece of furniture selling the paper because, on average, you're going to convert it to 32, 24, 38% interest. And that contract is worth a lot of money. This is not a game. This lesson is our wake-up call. Another thing they do, of course, is television, radio. We won't talk about that, or other media. But many of you that listen to my radio show every day can tell me the phone numbers of the advertisers because I tell them to you 2, 3, 4, 5, 6 times a day, depending on how many ads that advertiser buys from us. And it just keeps coming up over and over and over again because they keep writing the checks. And repetition does work. See, some people think, well, I'm a wise consumer. This doesn't impact me. Well, pride comes right before the fall. Let's see if repetition works. Let's think about this for just a second. Help me with this. Bye bye, Miss American.
Bye.
Drove my Chevy to the
levee.
But the levee was
dry.
Them good old boys were drinking whiskey and
rye.
Shame on you. Repetition doesn't work. Miss American Pie, Don McLean, 1972. Yes, a recent remake by Madonna. Miss American Pie. But most of you didn't hear the Madonna flick, okay? You got the other one, okay? This stuff doesn't work. Repetition has no impact on your buying, does it? Things go better with 1968. Wow. You deserve a break.
Yeah.
McDonald's, 1971. Where's the
Beef.
Wendy's, 1985. Clara Peller died in 1987. Have it your
way.
1973. Melts in your mouth, not in your M&M's started that slogan in 1954. Repetition doesn't work, does it? It has no effect on your buying, does it? I can promise you it has a huge effect on your buying. Product positioning has a huge effect on our buying. Now, product positioning can mean a lot of things in terms of a national marketing campaign. It can be simply brand recognition. Does anyone remember years ago when the generic brands first came out in the grocery stores and Hunt's and Heinz ketchup came back and had a big campaign over that? And they wanted Hunt's to be known, or Heinz to be known, as thick and rich. You remember that? Does anybody remember what the cost cutter was? It was runny, watery, made by the same company. Do you remember this? It's not a game. Hey, none of these major grocery chains have a Cheerio factory. When I open those, they look mysteriously like Cheerios. But we were sold. That's brand recognition. We attribute to that marketing a quality, a value that may or may not necessarily be there. Thus, generics have flourished in everything because we as consumers are starting to understand that. Brand recognition and association, associating certain things with brands. You know, it's amazing. Cadillac got so disgusted that Mercedes had a reputation for holding its value. And the actual statistical facts back in the 80s were that Cadillacs held their values better than Mercedes did in that particular decade. Cadillac spent like $100 million on full-page ads laying out all the full statistics showing that Cadillac, in reality, while they both go down in value like a rock, held its value better than a Mercedes. And they went back and did focus group studies after this huge advertising campaign, and no one still believed it. Because we have been indoctrinated to think that a Mercedes is an investment. Most of my investments, honey, go up. Think about this stuff, okay? Think about it. I'm not mad at Mercedes, but see, we have associated with that brand certain qualities that don't necessarily really exist. But that's an example of how that marketing branded, stamped within that product a reputation deserved or undeserved. Color affects what we purchase and how we purchase. Many years ago, when I first got in the real estate business, I worked for an ERA, an electronic realtor, broker, and they have these big, gaudy, ugly signs at that time that were this traffic orange and light blue. Does anybody remember those? And the big posts that they put them on were the traffic orange. They hired a company called the Color College in Kansas City that studied the eye identification with that orange, because guess what? As you're driving past homes, you need something that will catch your eye's attention, that peripheral vision will go, oh, look, honey, and it's got a picket fence. Because if you can make them turn and look more often, as we'll learn in the real estate section, that the signs sell houses. Well, ERA discovered this, and they paid hundreds of thousands of dollars to scientifically, with focus group studies, and judge the literal biological and physiological reaction of the eye to certain colors, and they designed this color to be the most likely to be attracted, and then along comes a really ugly yellow out of the same place by a company called Century 21 to accomplish exactly the same goal. A real estate person who opens their own business and puts a sign out with colors similar to trees and rocks and grass will not be in business long because no one ever sees their signs. It blends in. Color matters. Shelf position matters. Packaging matters. Big time, because we are impulse people. I mean, even people like me that teach this stuff, we can fall for an impulse. You go into the market, there's one of these iced down barrels there in the market, right? Now, they position these barrels just exactly right, because if they're too much out in the aisle, they're offensive. And you're like, that thing's in my way. If they're too much to the side, you don't notice them. So they literally will put the cameras up and study how people work their way around the barrel as they're designing the floor plans for these markets, the ones that are professionally done, and they set the barrel at exactly the right place to where it's not offensive, but to where you can't hardly miss it. You're just, oh, look at there. And it's a hot August day. I've just gone through the labor of pumping gas. And I look down there, and there is a Mountain Dew. And I pull it out, and as the ice slides down the side and drops off, in my subconscious, I just fell off a tire swing into a creek. And I walk up and pay more for this than I could have bought a case of them across the street at the grocery store for. This is not a game. Marketing is a real thing. Now, Mountain Dew's not evil. I drink one quite occasionally, and I can tell you my son Daniel just loves the things. But we have to stop and think as consumers if we're going to win. A significant purchase is particularly when we need to think if we're going to win. A significant purchase is anything over $300 in most households. Now, some of you really rich people, it might be $1,000. Some of you really, 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 really rich people, I don't know what it is. But a significant purchase is anything that causes you to jolt just a little bit. For most people, $300, $200 is a lot of money. It is for me, I can tell you that. And basically, the deal is this. Your body goes through physiological changes when you make a purchase of this size. Again, the marketers, the focus group studies, they have done the studies. There's a slight amount of perspiration in your palm, over your lip. Your eyes dilate slightly. Adrenaline is released. Proteins are released. Endorphins are released. It changes your eye dilation a little bit. The heart rate slightly shifts. In general, you get excited and your body shows it. And then when you buy that item and you lock in on that item and you bring it home 90 days same as cash because you had no intention of buying it when you went there. You impulse on it and you have no money. So you put it on the credit card or the 90 days same as cash. And how many of us have bought some large ticket item and by the time we get home and we wake up the next morning we go, oh, what have I done? And those of you that are married, you roll over and you look at your spouse and go, what did you let me do? Well, honey, there wasn't any stopping you. You were on a roll. You know what I mean? And you want to go see if you can take it back the next day. Several years ago, I worked for a real estate division of a large oil company. We were selling homes, large, expensive, custom homes. And we knew this thing called buyer's remorse that we're talking about here existed. So one of the things we did was as they signed a contract for a $200,000, a $300,000, or a $400,000 home, we would sit and discuss with them how buyer's remorse worked. We say normal people, when they're in the process of doing this, they go through physiological changes, and it is very normal. So to wake up the next morning and to have this feeling of regret, this feeling of, oh no, maybe I made a mistake. And so when you wake up in the morning and you feel that, just roll over, look at your spouse and go, guess what, honey, we're normal. And we would train them to be ready for buyer's remorse. And as soon as we started doing that training as part of the sales process, our contract rejections within 72 hours were cut more than in half. Because we taught these people how they were going to feel. Because we all face that when we're buying a large ticket item. So that even became a marketing issue. Isn't it amazing? Now, I'm telling you, we have to learn to say no. And it is tough to say no. I mean, it's rough. It's tough because I'll just tell you, every one of us it's kind of like this. How many of you are the oldest kids in your house when you were growing up? I was the oldest kid. We had it bad, didn't we? I mean, we had to break the parents in, didn't we? And they broke us in. And the little ones, they've got the ones younger than us. How many of you are babies in the family? That's not fair, is it? Y'all didn't get near as many beatings as we did. I mean, they wore out stuff on us and practicing, you know? And then by the time they get to you, I mean, you don't... And I'll just tell you, it's not fair because around our house, it's this way, okay? Our children are too old for this these days. But when our kids were little, we love our children beyond belief. But we do not allow and did not allow when they were little uncontrolled, angry temper fits. You could get your little tail tanned at my house for doing that. I know some of you don't like that, but you're what's wrong with North America. And if you really wanted to get your tail tanned, you could do a fit at the grocery store. Oh, baby. Don't play that. I remember one time, Daniel, my little guy, he's the smallest. Rachel and Denise are our older two. And one time, little Daniel, he saw something at the grocery store that he wanted, and he began to get that motor running. You know how they... It was starting to get going pretty good. You know how they do. And I remember the girls grabbed him one by each arm, took him over to the other aisle, and said, honey, you don't want to do that in the grocery store. You know? See, the youngest one, the older ones teach you, so you get by with stuff. I mean, the culture of the family is passed on. The oldest one's going, I didn't know the rules, you know? We learned by trial and error, didn't we? Well, you know what? I was in the grocery store the other day. I saw this lady in there, and she was like, the kid, her little toddler, bless his heart, he was in a phase four grocery store fit. You know, he was just screaming. The eyes were going, I want it, I want it, I want it, I want it. And you know, he doesn't know how close he is to child abuse. That vein in her head is doing this, right? She's holding him up just a little too high, carrying him out of there, right? You know, and she's yelling at him. It's not in the budget. It's not in the budget. I was scared to death she was going to say, Dave Ramsey said we couldn't have it. You know what I discovered? I discovered every one of us have one of those grocery store kids living inside of us. I was in the electronics store a little while back, and I went over on the big screen aisle, and that little kid inside of me woke up. And he said, "Ramsey, you travel all over the world, you give people financial peace, you sold all these books, and you need to watch the Super Bowl, and you need to watch the Stanley Cup, and you need a big screen." I heard them, they came over the intercom, "Big screen fit, aisle three." Man, I tell you what, I thought it was just me. I went by the furniture store, stopped in there right by the leather couches. I saw this beautiful young woman, and she was standing there going, "I want a leather couch. They smell good, and they last, and you're going to get me one. I want a couch." I went down about three aisles, and right there was the china cabinet. And there's another woman standing there going, "I know we have china we never use, but I want a cabinet to put it in." Then I drove to the car lot. Big old guy in there, about 350 pounds, looks like a linebacker, got a flat top, you know, standing by the four-wheel drives going, "If I had a really big truck, I'd be a real man. I want a big truck. It never snows here, but I need a four-wheel drive. I'm never going off-road, but just in case." Oh, don't you ladies laugh. I went over two aisles, and right there by the SUVs, "I want a safe car, something that's dependable with the leather smell, and I want an airbag in it that's not your mother." Then I went to the boat show. Good old boy standing over with his camouflage hat on, right by the bass boats going, "I need a bigger motor. Those bass are outrunning me." Drove over to the mall. There was a golf store there. "If I had a really big Bertha, I could hit it a long way." Have I got everybody yet? We all do this, don't we? We've all got that kid, that grocery store kid that lives inside of us. His name is immaturity. And we've established early and often in this course that children do what feels good. Adults devise a plan and follow it. None of those things we made fun of are bad. We own most of them at our house. There's absolutely nothing wrong with that. But children shouldn't make purchases in adults' bodies. It'll rob your financial peace. It causes you to do stupid things, and you live with this thing called regret later. It doesn't make sense. You end up in debt, and your kid's college fund isn't funded because you had a little temper fit in an adult's body. You have to learn to tell that child how to behave. Les Brown, the great motivator, says, sometimes if you're going to win, you have to talk to yourself. You have to say, "Shut up! Quit! No! No!" Sometimes if you're going to have financial peace, you have to look in the mirror and say, "Not today." One definition of maturity is learning to delay pleasure. And I'm going to help you establish a set of guidelines that tells you when you're making an appropriate purchase, when you have developed power over purchase. Because I'll tell you what, you have to learn to develop power over purchase because you will always spend more than you make until you learn to do that. I don't care what you make. I meet people on the radio and in our offices for counseling and in Financial Peace University all around the nation that make $80,000, $70,000, $60,000 and they're B-R-O-K-E broke. They have no money and $50,000, $60,000, $80,000 in credit card debt and student loans. And then I turn around and I meet someone else making $30,000 or $25,000 and they've got money in their 401k and emergency fund and they have no debt but their home and they're in the process of paying it off. Now, how come someone making $30,000 or $40,000 can do that and someone making $140,000 can't seem to pull it off? They haven't learned to tell that kid to shut up. One definition of maturity is learning to delay pleasure. You have to get this power over purchase. Then when you make a really nice purchase, you can enjoy the purchase. For years, we have saved and driven used and ridden used and worn used. And the other day, I made a purchase, one of my dream purchases in my lifetime, a competitive, competition, top-of-the-line, killer luxury ski boat, something I really, really want. You know what? I enjoy that boat. And part of the reason I enjoy it is it took a few years to get it. And it's the culmination, the fulfillment of a series of goals. I wanted to hit a certain net worth. I wanted to hit a certain income level and maintain it before I did something that was just pure consumption and luxury. There's nothing else you can call a ski boat, can you? But you can do that when you get your financial peace because you've done the smart stuff, because you've stayed under control, because you've been mature is what it amounts to. It gives you the money then to be immature. Let's look at these five steps, and I can tell you about these five steps. I have found, and Sharon, my wife and I have found, that over the years, if we do these five things on a significant purchase, a purchase of over $300, every single time we do these five things, we end up doing one of two things. Either A, not purchasing it and being very glad, or B, purchasing it and being very glad. It has added to our peace. It has added to the wisdom of the process of putting something together. If you buy something over $300 and you're married and you don't do these five steps, or you're single and you don't do most of these five steps, you will make mistakes. You will rationalize, you will justify, you will figure out some way to say that it's okay to make the purchase. Now, we don't need to say in Financial Peace University that the unwritten number six is, if you can't pay for it, you can't buy it. Okay? That's not on the page. That's just a given, all right? And as you said in your accountability groups and have discussion for accountability and for encouragement as you go through these series of classes together, you're going to have people there who will hold you accountable and go, you can't pay for it. You don't need to buy it. And that goes right with what we're talking about. That is a matter of simple maturity. It's like the old guy, the little couple was in. These salesmen, they have an effect. The little couple was in buying a car, and they were Christians, and they decided that they never, ever bought anything without doing what we're talking about here. Number one, wait overnight. They never bought anything without waiting overnight so that they could take time to pray about it and ask God if they were supposed to buy the item. And so the salesman, he had about had it. He hadn't had a good day. He needed to close a sale. And so they said, well, we need to wait overnight. And he said, well, why would you need to wait overnight? Well, we need to pray about it. And he said, I'll tell you what, I'll step out and we'll just close this room up and we'll just sanctify this room right here. And you guys can have some time right here for prayer. And so he left him in there for a few minutes. A few minutes, the little guy kind of timidly stuck his head out the door and he said, we're through. And the salesman came back in. He said, well, now, sir, we've prayed about it and we don't think we're supposed to do it right now. And the salesman said, just a minute. And he went over in the corner and he bowed his head. He came back in just a minute. He said, God wants to talk to y'all again. Sometimes these guys will do anything, won't they? Now, the truth is this. You got to learn to wait overnight. If it's a big item, wait overnight. It's amazing. When you get the fever, I mean, when this stuff is flowing through you, coursing through your veins, you need to wait because you cool off. Some of you get car fever. And you got to, you can't even talk well. You know, you just lose consciousness. So it's this, your pen just magically starts coming out of your pocket, heading towards the paper. I need a car. You see a dress, you see an item. Now again, if it's under $300, I'm not that concerned about it. But it's these large, stupid purchases at stupid times in our lives that cause us so much pain that I want you to stop doing. Wait overnight. But Dave, if I wait overnight, I'll come back. It might not be there. They've just got one. Right. What is it, a Picasso? They've got 17 in the back, shrink-wrapped on a pallet. Get a life. If not, the store in Vermont does, and they'll ship it in for you. Please, get a life. There's more than one. But let me just give you a hint, okay? If the item is gone the next day, and it was the only one left on planet Earth, it could be you weren't supposed to have it. No, Dave, no, don't say no. Don't say I was supposed to be denied something ever. No, I'm a consumer. Not anymore. You're now a wise consumer. Wait overnight. Now, the exception is if you're bidding at an auction and you know the item and you've already been shopping and done the research. Now, don't get all excited and pay too much. But if you really know everything there is to know about leather couches and there's one going at a deal, if you wait overnight, it really won't be there, okay? I mean, you do have to bid in that setting. But see, you have waited overnight because in order to know what you're bidding on, you've already been studying this purchase for quite a while. And you've already shopped and compared and knew what you were getting into. So it really isn't purely impulse. Now, if you walk up and never saw a leather couch before in your life and you start bidding, you'll probably pay two times too much and then you'll have lots of regret. Number two, you need to carefully consider your buying motives. Is this a need or a want? I'm amazed in talk radio how people call me and they use the wrong words. I was forced to buy a car. They had a gun. How were you forced to buy a car? There's no way you were forced to buy. Well, the radio knob fell off and it was breaking all the time. It was always breaking. It was always breaking down. It was, you wouldn't believe the repair bills. How much were they? $62. And it left me stranded and I got mad and went and bought a car. How many times have people done that? One. You weren't forced into squat. Is it a need or a want? Let me tell you what it is. It's a want. It's a want. That's what it is. Whatever it is you're considering, it's a want. Needs are food. Not many of you struggling there. Needs are clothing. No naked people. Needs are transportation. How many times have you visited another country? I was in one recently and they said, I was trying to go deep sea fishing and they said, well, it's about a 6-minute walk down there. And I'm going, 6-minute walk? I'm on vacation. Give me a cab. You know, I want one of those little scooters or something. Walk? And then I'm driving later. I did walk. But I'm driving later and I noticed that culture is they walk everywhere. Walking is normal everywhere, but here, right? I'm not suggesting you walk uphill 21 miles in the snow twice a day for the rest of your life. But sometimes for a period of time, one car wouldn't kill some of your families while you're cleaning up a mess and trying to get some of these debts paid. And then go get you a little beater car that you pay for, and that's the second car. How many of your parents had one car most of the time you were growing up? Oh, it's a new generation, isn't it? I mean, you talk to some of these people and you think they had to exist on one car in their household, you would think that the whole cotton-picking world had come to an end. It hasn't come to an end. Now, I don't want one car either. I got three kids. I mean, somebody would get hurt if we had one car with all the trips we have, you know? I'm not saying, but let's understand what a need is and what a want is. Most things we're going to buy are a want. Is it okay, though, to buy some wants? Say yes.
Yes.
I buy some wants. I've got some nice stuff at my house. I've already told you that. Stuff is not evil. So buy you some wants. But please don't call me and tell me you needed to buy another car. The one you've got's running. You needed a bigger house. Visit another country or the other end of town, for that matter, and see how many kids are in those bedrooms. How many of you shared a bedroom growing up? Oh, how many of your kids share a bedroom? Almost none, right? 78% of the 13-year-olds have a television in their room in America today. Is that bizarre? That's a generational thing. And I can promise you that one's not a need. Again, nothing wrong with that. Well, there might be, but nothing wrong with that. The bottom line, though, is we can't call that something it's not. It is not a need. See, we get confused. We start thinking that stuff is going to make us happy. No amount of stuff equals contentment or fulfillment. Now, I like stuff. I'm not against stuff. Again, I'm not one of these financial guys who thinks you ought to live in a cave and collect lint. Okay? I'm not one of those people. I think you need to enjoy your money, enjoy your stuff as part of having financial peace. But when you get confused and start thinking, I'll be happy when we can live over there, when I can wear that, when I can drive that, I'll be happy when, that's when you've gotten happiness and fun confused. See, you can buy fun. Our family went on a really nice cruise this year. I can tell you that was fun. But it didn't make us happy. What's happy is when I'm tucking my little boy in at night, saying his prayers with him, he looks up at me and says, Daddy, I love you. That's happy. Don't get happy and fun confused. You can buy fun. You cannot buy happy. And if you get caught up in this trap, I'll be happy when? You'll chase it the rest of your life. Joe Land tells this story. He tells about the idea of when we go to kindergarten, we start this. You remember all the way up through school? You're in kindergarten. I remember I had a kindergartner in my house, came home and said, "Daddy, I'll be happy when I get to the first grade." They read there. Then they got to the first grade and they found out there were these mean things called sixth graders that ruled the school. Little school mafia thing going on. You remember sixth graders. They put first graders in lockers. You remember them. Okay? And then you're sitting there in first grade and you're going, "Man, when I get to be a sixth grader, I'll be happy then." You remember this? And then you get into sixth grade and you look over there into middle school, into junior high school, and you see they've got football and cheerleaders and they change classes and they go, man, they wear different clothes to the playground. I'll be happy when I get to middle school. You remember that? Then you get over there to middle school and you're walking around and then somebody's older brother over in high school, older sister over in high school comes in and says, "Got my driver's license. Freedom! I'm ready now." And you go, "Man, when I get to high school, I get my driver's license, I'll be free, I'll be happy then." Then you get to high school and you're over there, everything seems to be okay till that same older brother, older sister comes home from college. Says, "Man, college is cool. Nobody's watching you. They don't even care if you go to class in college. I love college." And you go, "Man, I'll be happy when I get to college." Then you get over to college and your net worth is a half a box of no-dos. And you're trying to work your way through and you're throwing pizzas and delivering papers or delivering pizzas and throwing papers. And you're trying to figure this deal out and it's all-nighters for tests. And you're thinking, "Man, if I could just get out of here and I could start my life in that new job." And then you get out of college, "I'll be happy then." And you get out of college and you go get that new job and you know they're smart because they hired you. And you know everything at that point, so you know for sure they're smart. And you go along a few months and they fire you. You go, "Man, I'll be happy if I had some stability. Man, I'd be happy if I could meet that special someone, get married, have 2.5 kids and a picket fence. I'll be happy then." And you get married, you meet that special someone. And you walk down the aisle and "I'll be happy now." Then your parents start calling, going, "If you'd have some grandbabies, I'd be happy." And you have some grandbabies and you go, "Man, if they would just not do the diaper thing. If I could get them potty trained, I'll be happy. Get the last one potty trained." You remember this. "I'll be happy then." Then you finally get the last one potty trained and you blink and they're teenagers. You go, "Man, when they leave home, I'll be happy then." And then they leave home and you go, "If you'd come home, I'll be happy then." Then they get married and you say, "If you'd have some babies so I could change some diapers, I'd be happy then." If you don't watch, you chase happiness all your life. Let me tell you, happiness is where you are right now. You got to make a decision. Contentment is not somewhere else. Happiness is a bully in the schoolyard if you play it like that. Draws a line in the sand, says, "Step over here." And you step across and he backs up and draws another line. Because he doesn't really want to fight, does he? That's happiness. You'll chase it all the time like that. "Yeah, I'll be happy when I buy." No, you won't. See, you buy that perfect car, that one you've always wanted. I mean, it's a babe. It's a babe on wheels. And you park it at the mall. And some kid bounces a door off of it like it's a basketball. "Hey, my car, you can't keep your stuff. It's just stuff. He with the most toys when he dies is dead." It's the old preacher's joke. "I've never seen a rider truck following a hearse." Nothing wrong with stuff, but it's a want. And you won't be happy then, because how many times have we bought one and someone else had one just a little bigger, a little better, and you keep chasing that thing? You don't want to keep up with the Joneses. Statistically, we know where they're headed. Bankruptcy court. They have their own private parking spot. You don't want to keep up with these guys. The third thing is, never buy anything that you don't understand. Especially in the area of insurance and investments, and we'll teach you about those things so that you don't get messed up. But just don't buy anything. If you can't tell me how it works, don't buy it. Well, Dave, I never do that. Right. And that VCR is at home blinking 12. Especially with investments, especially with real estate and mortgages, especially with financial things, don't be intimidated. Look at them and say, I'll have to wait until you can explain it to me to where I can understand it. And if you can't, then you don't get to make the sale. Never buy something you half understand because someone put a little pressure on you with a really good suit. Never, ever do that. Don't buy things you don't understand. Number four, consider the opportunity cost of your money. If I take $5,000 or $10,000, let's say $5,000 cash, and I go on a cruise, that money is gone, and by definition, it loses the opportunity to do something else. If I wanted to fund a Roth IRA for $3,000 and instead I went on a cruise and I didn't fund the Roth IRA, well, neither one is evil or wrong. One is consumption, one is investment. One might be wiser than the other, but either one's okay, technically speaking. But by doing the Roth IRA, I lose the opportunity to go on the cruise. By doing the cruise, I lose the opportunity to do the Roth IRA. The point is, when you get ready to do a large purchase, think, is there something else I might rather do with that money? And that's the opportunity cost. Now, what opportunity am I not going to get to take advantage of because I purchased or invested or did that with the money? What am I missing over here? A friend of mine who is a multimillionaire that sells investments was very successful at a very young age. And he in his life illustrated this in a story he tells from the stage, shared a stage with him just a little while back. An amazing story. It illustrates it perfectly. He was 26 years old, and his goal was to make his first $100,000 income year. And he was good. He was on his way. That's pretty sharp at 26, would you agree? And he's out there, and he's selling investments, and he had saved up $40,000 cash. And this is 1982. $40,000 cash, it was setting in his mutual fund. And his goal was, when I hit $100,000 this year, I'm going to treat myself for working hard and hitting that goal. I'm going to take that $40,000 and I'm going to buy a brand new Mercedes. Now, in 1982, $40,000 would buy a pretty nice brand new Mercedes. That's a while back, keep that in mind. Now, what he did was, he hit his $100,000, right? So he takes his $40,000 out. He said, I got in my Volkswagen Diesel Rabbit that I hated. Everywhere I went, my clothes smelled like diesel. You had to push it down the ramp to get it up to 55 miles an hour. And he said, I drove up to the Mercedes dealer. Now, he's a 26-year-old kid and a Diesel Rabbit. The Mercedes dealer asked him what he's there to deliver. And he said, well, I'm actually here to buy that one. And the guy says, well, how are you going to pay for it? And he said, well, I have the cash. I just pulled it out of my mutual fund. Suddenly, he got the salesman's attention. And the salesman did what's called the puppy dog close. He sent the item with him. RCA perfected the puppy dog close back in the 50s with televisions. They would send the television home with you for a test drive. And when all the neighborhood came around and saw that you got a television, pride would not let you bring it back. The puppy dog is, if you take the puppy dog home, it's too cute and cuddly to bring back, so you buy the item. That's what the test drive is called. It's a puppy dog close. Let you take the car home overnight and all your friends see it. He said, I got behind that wheel of that Mercedes, Dave. He said, it was sweet. I was driving that thing. I drove up to my parking spot in the office. Everybody came out of the office and said, man, way to go. You've done a great job. You deserve this. You're the man. Look at this. Everybody's bragging on my car. I hadn't bought it yet. I'm test driving it. He said, I drove it home. And he said, it was the coolest thing. He said, out there on the hood was an emblem, the Mercedes emblem, looking at you. And that emblem was talking to me. It said, you're a success. You're a success. You're a winner. And he said, in case I forget to look out there, they've got one on the steering wheel, too. And he said, I'm driving that thing along. I'm enjoying that thing. And he said, I got home. And he said, I told my wife, this is the safest car, and they hold their value. And all my neighbors came around and they said, man, this is a great car and you deserve your success. You've worked so hard. And he said, I almost bought it. He said, Dave, I made a mistake. I got my calculator out. And I looked at, because I sell mutual funds, what those mutual funds might be worth someday. And he said, I drove that car back and I picked up my old diesel rabbit. He said, I went and bought me a $6,000 old Chevrolet, slightly used. And He said, I drove that for many years. He said, the weirdest thing happened the other day. Now, the time that I was sharing a stage with him that I got to hear this story the first time was back in 1994, 12 years after the story occurred. And that's the first time I met this gentleman. And he said, Dave, true story, I was driving along the other day in my Rolls Royce, thinking of Grey Poupon. And he said, I pulled up at a stoplight, and a guy pulled up in that same car that I had looked at all those years before, a 1982 Mercedes, the same color that I had wanted. He said, I couldn't resist. He said, I rolled down my window, and he said, I asked the guy, had him roll down his window. He said, I asked him, he said, I don't want to be rude or anything, sir, but what's that car worth? And the guy got a big smile on his face, and he said, man, it is perfect condition, low miles, all the records are here. I just bought it for $4,000. And he said, I kind of smiled to myself and I went home and I pulled the mutual fund statement out of my drawer because I'd never added anything else to that $40,000. And from 1982 to 1994, 12 years, the mutual fund had grown from $40,000 to $285,000 and the $40,000 car was worth $4,000. That's opportunity cost on your money. Nothing evil or wrong about buying a $40,000 Mercedes, but that illustrates what that money can become when we let it do the right kinds of things and we don't fall for it. Because see, now he is a multimillionaire because he continued to make decisions like that and literally really does have a Rolls Royce. What an amazing thing. Not sure I want one. I kind of think they're ugly, but still. Number five, you need to seek the counsel of your spouse. How many of you are married in here or hope to be someday? You need to learn this one.
Well, Dave, I'm independent. I don't have to seek the counsel of my spouse. I'm an independent woman.
No, you're a stupid woman.
Well, Dave, I'm the macho man. I get to make all the decisions in my house. The little woman just follows me.
No, you're a stupid man. When God said you are now one, when you start making major decisions by yourself, you're doing it with half your brain. You need to discuss this with your spouse. You don't have to go get their permission. You need to talk it through and seek their wisdom. I can tell you in my household, this is a tough thing because I'm kind of a hard-charging D-type, go get it done, and Sharon's real easygoing, and so I just went and got it done. And I can tell you in those days we owned all that real estate before we went broke, I have owned several pieces of real estate that Sharon has never seen because I was doing some deals, and she didn't care. I just started doing deals. And occasionally she'd say, now what's up with so-and-so? She'd have this feeling. Don't you hate it, guys, when your wife gets a feel? I really hate it because they're always stinking, right? I just don't like it at all. And the proverb tells us this. Let me tell you, this is a financial principle. Look at it very carefully. Who can find a virtuous wife? For her worth is far above rubies. The heart of her husband safely trusts her, so he will have, get it, no lack of gain. Say it with me, guys. He will have no lack of gain. Guys, do you see what that says? It says if you take the counsel of a virtuous wife, you will have no lack of gain. Guys, that means you have to listen to your wife's input if she's virtuous. Ladies, it said virtuous. It didn't say barking chihuahua. Keep in mind, there's another proverb that says it's better to live in the corner of a housetop than with a contentious woman. It is much like dripping, dripping, dripping rain to live with a contentious woman. This is the same book in the Bible that says that both of these things. Okay, keep this in mind. So guys, you need to listen to your wives. But as Larry Burkett says, ladies, this does not give you permission to become the Holy Spirit. Ladies, is there implications here for you? You bet. Good enough for one, it's good enough for the other. A lady will have no lack of gain when she takes the covering and wisdom of her husband's input in the process. God put you together because you need each other. You need each other. As Larry Burkett says, we talk about this. If two people just alike get married, one of you is unnecessary, remember, right? Now the deal is this, gang. You've got to talk about this stuff. You have to discuss it. We take this so seriously at our house. And it's such a warning to me because it's so easy. I am not one who is lacking in courage to make a decision. Can you imagine that? And Sharon is not, it's easy for her to be non-confrontational and just go along. But we talk through this stuff. Sometimes we fight through it a little bit. But Sharon's a full-time mom, and let me tell you how seriously we take this at our office. Up until just recently, when we had 50 team members, up until then, every single person that has come to work with us on our team, Sharon has first interviewed them. And now that has been passed on to where our vice presidents of the divisions and their spouses do the interviewing with their spouses. But the last step to come to work for us has always been, you got to sit down and talk with Sharon at lunch. Now, it's not real intimidating. Sharon's pretty easygoing. But if she gets one of those feelings, you're in trouble. Never happens. Almost never happens. Very seldom happens. And the other thing we've learned is we want to interview your spouse. Because if you're married to psycho chick, you're not going to be much of an employee. Or psycho husband, you're not, you know, if you've got all this other junk going on, I want to know it ahead of time, and I'll just let you go get ministered to somewhere else. You know? That's not the business we're in. So that sounds mean, doesn't it? But he who listens to a virtuous wife will have no lack of gain. Sharon sits and goes through our books at our business, and she's a full-time mom with a home ec degree. Because sometimes she's got that little conservative thing that comes up, that little security glance. She goes, guys, I think we're spending too much. And the guys are going, oh, Sharon said that. She has legendary respect through our company. Because we believe this proverb to be true, because it is. It's straight out of God's word. It's not a mistake. So if you'll do these five things when you get ready to do a major purchase, you will win. You will not have regret. You will have blessing. And you will have good stuff. And you will have more good stuff because you will have the money to get good stuff. But you got to go through these five steps before you buy something. A, you've got to wait overnight. B, number two, you have to carefully consider your motives. Three, you don't buy anything that you don't understand. Four, you consider the opportunity cost. What else could I do with the money? And five, when you're in a marriage situation, you first seek the counsel of your spouse. If you do these things, you will begin to achieve financial peace. Thanks.
My wife and I go shopping. We take turns warning each other about impulsing. This is walk down the aisle. You want? Oh, I want that. No, that's an impulse. Okay, then 10 feet later, I'm wanting something. Oh, that's an impulse.
It's definitely an art, and it's something that the average consumer, if they're not aware of the things he's talking about, will be victim.
I'm not going to have a car payment. You know, I shouldn't have a car payment. You know, I thought leasing cars was the best way to get the most car for the money. Yeah, right. But it was just so foreign that it was really difficult to face.
I had a brother-in-law that used to sell cars, and he let me in on some things, and I think it holds to be true. They will play the man and his spouse, or the one spouse against the other, because if they see and they can smell it that she wants it or he wants it, once that's noted and they know this, they'll go out and they'll come back and they'll play on that individual's sympathy. Mm-hmm. You know, like, well, you know, she really likes that, you know, and he likes that.
Credit cards reek.